What do the founders of Calm, Planet Organic, Photobox, Moonpig, Shazam, Mumsnet, Last Minute, WeTransfer, Albright, and the School of Life all have in common? They all put their brain first and start their day with Heights. Heights is the smart supplement for brain health and cognitive performance using plant-based natural ingredients designed to help you thrive. Listeners of this show can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Hello, listeners. In the great words of the fantastic John Bon Jovi, we're halfway there. That is 8 episodes out of 16 of the series Into the Secret Lives of Leaders. And today's guests, we have a quite phenomenal woman by the name of Reshma Sahoni, who is the co-founder of SeedCamp, which is Europe's premier VC seed fund. Rich, do you want to tell us more of what we can enjoy today?
Yeah, so Reshma is a really interesting interview. It's kind of taking a look from the other side of the table. Anybody who's kind of interested in getting involved in venture investing, but also actually, you know, from the entrepreneur's side, it's also there's a lot of insight there. What was very interesting with SeedCamp is actually their investment in TransferWise, which wasn't such a superb investment. I think it returned the entire value of the fund in that one investment multiple times over, and that's without even selling their whole stake in it. So very, very experienced investor, knows what to look for when investing in startups, and gives some really great insights and tips as to what to look for in this interview.
And very honest as well, very honest about the sort of different things that she does like, doesn't like, and her relationship with her co-founder, their strengths and weaknesses as well. So definitely if you are an early stage entrepreneur and you're looking for your first round, your first proper round, SeedCamp are probably going to be top of your list. So if you want to know how to raise the important money from the best people, this is the one for you.
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to The Secret Lives of Leaders.
A very lovely welcome to one of the best network ladies in UK tech. As the co-founder of not only the first ever, but also arguably the most successful seed fund in Europe, SeedCamp. A quick way to test the quality of Reshma's SeedCamp is knowing the fact that in the early days of Grabble, we were rejected by them. For all the right reasons, of course. This was before we moved to mobile, but one way or another, they know how to pick a winner, even if they might miss a few along the way. Right?
Not just you guys. We've missed a few more.
Okay, good. Good to hear. Thanks.
City Mapper, Deliveroo.
Are you crazy?
I know.
Can't believe we missed the big three. Anyway, by only part selling their stake in the most successful investment, they've already returned their entire fund back, as the high-profile fintech unicorn TransferWise was originally developed before Reshma's eyes, and with her support and brain power. Most importantly, brain power, of course, right? Yeah. With over 200 investments to her name, it's not fair to focus only on their largest, as they've backed many really exciting winners, which she'll be talking to us about today. With her roots from India, teenage years in America, and an MBA in France, it's Europe she has chosen of the three continents to call home. And it's fair to say she's had a huge impact on the technology scene here. So we're better off thanks to her and her lovely co-founder, Carlos. So Reshma, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
So SeedCamp is 10 years old. How does that feel?
Yeah, we're almost there this September. It's incredible. I mean, time does move very fast in the startup world.
Yeah.
And being a co-founder of a startup ourselves, it's certainly moved at sort of light speed, right?
Do you feel like an entrepreneur being co-founder of a fund? It's always interesting. VCs do quite often consider themselves entrepreneurs.
Yeah, no, for sure. Look, I think, when we set it up, when you set up anything from zero to one, you're an entrepreneur, right? And all the more when people think you're crazy, probably. So, we were a disruptive force. Nothing like this was ever done. We were bringing a product to market, which was seed funding, and the nature of it kind of through these application processes and saying, no matter what, we'll invest. So that was, fairly disruptive. And then you have your messaging. Who are you targeting? What's your customer base? You're checking if your customer likes you. Do they like the product? Mm-hmm. So you kind of do all of that over this decade, this time period. So it's not dissimilar. And we use technology as a clear kind of our toolkit, right? And again, a critical part of how we grow and how we help our companies. So on all those fronts.
Definitely a startup then.
Yeah.
Just a scale up.
Okay.
Because you've got the 10-year marker, so you have
to. That's right. That's right.
The difference. So on that note, what is SeedCamp?
So, you know, as all good things, I think, and you guys, you know, I'm sure you go through this thinking about this as you evolve. And so what is SeedCamp? I think we're at the core, the mission still is we want to give, you know, European talent a stand on the global stage, and we want to help build, you know, extremely relevant businesses. And to us, that means sort of billion, multi-billion, hundreds of billions worth of value, right? Because that kind of shows you're really impacting, again, at a very global stage. So that core mission hasn't changed. And we want to do it. We want to do it for people who come from anywhere and through all kinds of backgrounds as well. So that's the core. But how we've evolved is we're definitely putting more capital to work. So, you know, our check sizes have gone from 50K to in a new fund that we're fundraising for, there'll be more sort of 150K to 400K. So that's quite a dramatic evolution. But it meets the needs of our customers, customers.
Also so. Probably meets the need of there's much more, competition, I guess is the right word. There's more startups now and it's more of a thing to leave your corporate job and try something. And a lot of very intelligent people are doing that, which makes it an incredibly competitive market, and you do need more capital to get from A to B.
Absolutely. And both from competition for you guys, but for competition for us as well. And we're, you know, our view is we always want to stay ahead of it and let the competition sort of come behind us. And from a micro level, it's always like, oh, there's competition. But from a macro level, it's exactly what we set out to do 10 years ago, is to have, you know, 600 of organizations that were us sort of 10 years ago. Now there's, you know, a few hundred of those, right? That's exactly
so
what we wanted.
Who do you see as your competition, like direct competition? Because you just mentioned Index, but they're surely not a competitor of yours, really. You're more surely partners in many ways.
Exactly. I mean, that was contextually different when we were talking about it. So no, I mean, we're fortunate and quite unique in that a lot of the VCs and angels have actually funded us and, you know, essentially Saul Klein, who was co-founder of SeedCamp with me, was at Index at the time. So Indexer co-founder and the guys at, you know, Atomico and all of those folks, we started it all up together. So the VCs and angels are in there. We have family offices and so forth. So I think that said, this industry is quite different, again, how you guys operate is there's so much co-optation. So we're competitive, but we're cooperating a ton. So look, with our 150K checks, you know, I'm sure, why did we pick that number? It didn't come out of thin air. You know, you see a lot of SEIS, right? But what we're hearing a lot in the market is founders love the fact that there is so much more kind of capital at that stage, but the terms aren't always great and they're not always getting the support that they need to go to the next stage. And you're seeing these like first seed, second seed, third seed rounds, and that dilutes the founders quite a lot. It messes up the cap table. So we kind of said, you know, this is a place where we can really make a difference. And so 150K, almost like a speed seed round is what we're, you know, trying to do next, is to get into that layer. And so to some extent, I'm sure we compete with some angels, but one of the things we want to do is with our 150, allow angels to also co-invest with us at that stage.
Okay.
And then in the rounds where we're, you know, writing the 300, 400K checks, they're often going to be 1 to 2 million. So we're going to be the second largest check there. Mm. And for there, again, VC is probably going to lead it. They're going to be angels. There's going to be us involved. So will we end up displacing a few angels or another VC? Probably.
Okay.
But that's, again, the nature of it, right?
That makes sense. Can you give us some idea of some of the companies you've backed? Give us some of the range of ones that jump out at you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it always... So it's interesting about venture investing, and if you're at this sort of bleeding edge, you're always looking out like 5 to 10 years, and you're trying to make these bets of a company or a set of founders that's gonna last that time. So it's you know, it's fascinating to kind of be at that level, and then a few years in, people are like, "Oh yeah, of course that was always gonna happen, right?" So
TransferWise was always really obvious.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you know, I think those guys will tell you like their first round was after us was tough. It wasn't a total, you know, cakewalk, right? So, but look, fintech. Yeah, we backed our first fintech in 2007. And it was, you know, it
recession.
Yeah. And, yeah. But the technology wasn't there. The distribution kind of wasn't there. And ultimately it failed, but it all gave us a taste of what financial services, you know, consumed on the mobile could look like in a few more years when things caught up. Right. And so then obviously you've seen us do TransferWise, but, we just caught up with Nikolai of Revolut, kind of how they're launching products. At such speed is immense to sort of watch and see, you know, see their growth. And we brought back to Moneys and Curve and so forth and in, you know, fintech, prop tech. Again, we kind of looked at that market quite early in the last sort of 2-3 years ago and said, all right, how is this market changing? So we're looking a lot at that and health tech, ed tech, AI, obviously, and so forth. So, you know, given the volume we do, we're investing in 40 companies a year, okay, roughly. It's like you got to look very cross sector and, you know, quite horizontal.
What's the process? So someone comes in. So for those who don't know, how does it actually work? So I want to apply to Seedcamp. How do I do it? And what's the process I would expect going through with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the risks, you know, we run into now 10 years old is we're so well known. And so we have a huge network as well. Mm. So one of the risks is that we're not true to our mission, which was to back someone from anywhere, any background, all of that, right? So really important part of what we do is we have a very open application system. And we'll, you know, we'll change that and evolve how that's done. But essentially, you could be from literally any corner of Europe or the planet. And if Europe's of interest, you know, you come through that application process. So that's on the sort of 150K check level.
Yeah.
And then the 300K to 400K, it's extremely network driven. So we really, on that, we definitely do not, really take completely blind sort of people coming into us. It's very network driven. So we have those two approaches.
And how many of the later stage ones are there as opportunities? 300 or 400K checks. How many of them do you expect to deploy a year?
Yeah, so we want to do at the 150K, we want to do about 20 to 25. And then in the 300 to 400K, about 10 to 15 a year.
Okay.
So the relationships are really important, right?
And is it like a course or is it just like mentorship? Because, you know, do you spend like time going through like an actual program or?
Yeah. I mean, I think the luxury of being around for as long as we have is we've tried a number of things and you know, we're better and smarter about what works and what doesn't. So in terms of both sets of companies, they come in through different ways, but they actually become part of the same network. Mm-hmm. And the network, you know, those network effects that you guys have in, you know, your businesses, similarly to ours, we now have a founder group of 500 plus people. We have, you know, co-investors, 600 unique co-investors in our companies. We have 50 LPs in our fund. Mm. Those network effects are incredible. So basically what we do is, you know, take these 40 companies a year and in batches, have them go through a system of support. And it's extremely intense the first 3 months. 3 to 9 months, we work a lot on milestones, fundraising, how do you get to that next big jump?
Yep.
And then 9 months onwards, they often have others around them. So whether it's angels or VCs or whatnot. And so we work, you know, hand in hand with those guys saying, okay, you guys are working with them on this and you guys are doing this. Let us, you know, let's do this, this or that with them. So it sort of changes over time.
How did it actually start with you and Carlos? Like, where did you guys meet? Why Carlos? Why you? How does any of that make sense? Neither of you are British or even, is Carlos even European?
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, originally, obviously, it started with me and Saul back in 2007.
Right.
So,
well, let's take us back to that. Okay, then. Tell us the story of how Seedcamp started.
Yeah. It's really kind of, it's funny. I'm not sure I've even shared it quite in this kind of a forum. So, at the time, I was at 3i. Saul had just come from Skype into Index, and you know, Nicholas and Matthias were setting up Atomico post Skype as well. So you had this kind of group of people doing quite new things, again, kind of changing from and I'd come from Vodafone. So, you know, we were shifting ourselves personally, and the kind of VC industry was just, you know, really starting to come together a lot. TechCrunch had just, I think, been launched and also growing, quite early days of growth and launching in Europe. So you had all these sort of, you know, interesting forces, and we got to know each other quite quickly because it was such a small community at the time. And in that time,
co-optition,
exactly. And in that time, Saul, you know, I think I'd been watching YC, that was 2 years old by that point. I think Techstars was a year old. And he started to talk to a few people, including he came into 3i to say, hey, why don't we do a summer kind of a program, camp, you know, around giving startups money. And I think sort of I was leaving as wanting to leave 3i at the time. They kind of wanted me to leave as well. And so it was just not the right fit. And same thing as entrepreneurs. It's like I was thinking, what next for me, right? I'd been in Vodafone and I'd been in venture back in New York for a little bit. So I really loved venture. I thought it was my calling, but I wanted to do it in a different way. And, you know, a year later, 3i left venture anyway. So a lot of the things I saw that I didn't think worked well for founders, and especially first-time founders, and especially founders who didn't already know, you know, the Atlas guys at the time, or Benchmark at the time, or Index, just thought, how did these guys and girls get through the door? Yeah. And so all those ideas came to, you know, it's a confluence of those ideas. They came together in what Saul was sort of taking around to a few different folks. And I said, you know, hey, 3i's willing to let me work on this for 6 months. And, you know, I'd love to do this and help you out. And it just sort of got going from there. And Saul kind of announced Seed Camp there. And in the background, as you do when you're launching your companies, we were just coding and building the application system. And it's like, oh God, we got to go live. And this is going to, you know, we have like 2 days to make this go live. So it's just, again, it's fun and interesting. And that's what, you know, you often talk to, like you talk to Tavid or you guys as well, is what was the, you know, what are the fun bits? And it was those early days of just doing stuff in the back. And anyway, so that launched. And I think we were astounded by where applications came from, literally all across Europe, for an entity that didn't exist, right? 3 months before. So it was just, yeah, we were astounded by the response. And we got some great companies. I mean, My Builders become kind of a known brand in the UK in terms of, you know, getting builders or people to work on your home. And Zamanta guys were pretty well known. They've moved to New York now. But we got some great, you know, very early companies there. And it just went from there. So it's just luck. Well, it's luck in being in the right place at the right time with the right kind of attitude and, you know, network, right, obviously.
Of course. And I guess, you know, really unique positioning for a competitive market, as in there just weren't that many other people in that space at that early. Yeah. And if you are a first-time entrepreneur especially, then all the hand-holding is a massive value add. And you wouldn't know where to go for it.
And I think the fact that we went around, you know, and then when I joined Saul, we went around and said to all the VCs, come in behind this. So we didn't sort of partner up with just one fund or one entity and you know, shoot from there. We said to Eden and Nordstone and Balderton and Atomico and Index and Atlas. I mean, they all came in. Anthemis and they all, Venrex, they all came in into this first fund, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Like, how do you get that many VCs to
work
together? I guess
for them it's deal flow, right? They want that deal flow,
exactly.
So they're doing it for their best interests as well, because
exactly.
they get early access to the metrics and the information of the companies they want to fund.
Yeah. And then what we really got mostly out of them, though, was their network and their time. Most importantly, their time and their desire to mentor and give back. And that's probably crucial. So, you know, we all talk about a lot about money, but really that time and that mentorship. And backing, you know, backing our companies in those next rounds. So I think, you know, Eden did like 3 or 4 companies. You know, I think Atlas did 1 or 2. I mean, that was huge that we had that backing right after.
Question that you're definitely not going to want to answer, which is especially why I'm going to ask it. But so who's your favorite fund you've worked with on later stage? Everyone has a favorite, so no one will be offended. And now anyone that's not that favorite fund would know they need to work harder for Rashmi's love. So that's opportunity.
So I think actually this is where we try to differentiate a bit. Is
we have no favorites.
No, that's not. I can name a few.
Good.
No, I won't shy away from the question.
Good.
I don't think it's about funds. I think it's, and I think this is where we differentiate. I think with Seed Camp we try to. For it not to be at all about sort of Carlos or me. We try to have it be about Seed Camp, which is our EIRs, our mentors, us, our team. Whereas with funds, I do think it's different because you do get a partner on, or you know, team of partner associate on your board. And they're very much responsible for you as a business from zero to IPO, right? So I guess probably don't have favorites in terms of funds, but you know who we really enjoy working with. I mean, Robin Klein is just an incredible kind of incredible champion for years of business, board member. And tough kind of will push you also, right? And, yeah. You know, Fred Destin.
Very successful.
Very successful.
Yeah.
Fred Destin as well. He's now obviously at Excel. He was on the C-Camp board. So we actually uniquely also had a board and these guys were on it. And so, you know, love working with him. He's very much, again, he'll push, he'll challenge, but he very much lets go in terms of this is your business, you got to run it.
Yeah.
And you know, I've done the best in terms of my knowledge and my advice. So I guess where I, you know, and people are different in their kind of who they like to work with and whatnot. I guess, you know, Carlos and I really value board members who can really spot the real issues.
Yeah.
The two or three real issues in a business, and then, you know, put a lot of energy behind that, and then the rest, you know, doesn't matter as much, right? And they
sure.
don't get worked over or worked up about that.
So to clarify, did not shy away from the question, but did not answer the question. So are you going to be a politician one day? Do you think that's going to happen?
Absolutely. Actually, I had this like vision when I was younger. I was like, I will be a U.S. senator.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't be the president because I wasn't born in the U.S.
Right.
And I couldn't be a couple of things. Vice president, yeah. I think.
But you've got a good reputation. Well. Why ruin it by going into politics? No one likes politicians.
So that was 20 plus years ago,
okay,
right?
Because cool.
I'm so old and now I don't want to be. But
Right, okay. Now you realize how nice it is to be liked. This is no point. For people that don't understand, can you just give us literally these super basics on how the general equity structure or like logistics behind a fund works?
Yes, absolutely. So you know, actually not dissimilar to the fundraising process you guys go through, every few years, you know, VCs at different stages go through the same fundraising process. We go out with our deck and our story and our vision. And actually what's happening is if you look at smaller funds like us, so sub 100 million funds, we're going out the market faster and faster. So you're getting, you know, us out to market to raise every nowadays sort of 2 years, 3 years, sometimes 18 months, which is again not dissimilar to you guys, right? So that's on the kind of the start of what we do. And look, I mean, I think there's two things. Is, you know, people get wrapped up in are you backing me and you're backing me as a founder and we're in this together and it's a marriage and it's long term? Yes, but we are managing money. Mm. We are an asset manager and you know, we're managing whether it's tens of millions, hundreds or billion on behalf of it. Sometimes you, right, your pension money or such will be in there, up to obviously educational institutions or whatnot. So to, you know, I think you can't disregard that. And I think as a VC asset class, we've done a bad job of actually talking about the money side of it. I think we've, you know, gone with the hype, yeah, about the founder journey and being there, but we're managing money. So anyway, so why is that so important? It dictates a lot of the way we think of how we invest. So, you know, the natural tendency is, so you kick off and then you have your 2-3 years of your core investing, and then you're going to ride sort of the rest in terms of follow-ons and so forth, especially for our stage is really crucial, those first 2.5-3 years of investing. And it's interesting, like, you know, you'll take different risks at the beginning of the fund because you know you have 9 or 10 years to prove out that business. You'll take different risks at year 3. It's the nature of it. And you'll take different, you know, you'll choose different things based on what sectors you've invested in. So Grabble, for example, you know, you said, oh, we got rejected by C-Camp. I bet you, part of it was like, we had done Nuji at the time,
yeah.
And I think we had done a few things.
Yeah,
and you're like,
and we were similar then too, because we were web,
yeah,
originally,
exactly, right. And also not just like similar, and we don't want to invest in super competitive things. But the other thing is like, oh my God, we're exposed now to prop tech or fintech,
sure.
or retail tech or whatever it is. So that's also, you know, informs kind of our strategy as we move through, and for VCs as well as those 3-4 years, right? So that's kind of a lot of things to keep in mind, and also where you've been burned. Like we've had some tough times in food tech, and things we've we passed on, missed, and things we have back that hasn't worked, right?
Yeah.
So next time you see a food tech, you're like, oh, okay.
Mm.
Tougher.
Yeah.
So does that answer your question?
Yes, yeah. It does. But I mean, also I wanted to know a little bit, getting down to specifics. Say, for example, different kind of way, but we had Simon Cook, who I guess was with his 3A. Is that right this time?
He was a DFJ Spree.
No, I know, but I think originally.
It probably was. No, before my time, though.
Let's just say that at some point I'm going to get someone that was a 3A, correct? anyway.
Daniel Waterhouse?
Yes, there you go.
There you go.
He was definitely a 3A.
Yeah.
And anyway, so Simon told us all about the history of EC, and it was really interesting how it all started in the valley and the whole long story behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we didn't touch on is specifically how does a fund work from the financing perspective. So what percentage typically does a fund take? How does it get a return?
Right.
How is the incentive works? I think that's quite interesting for those that just don't know.
Yeah.
And if you don't know,
then
it doesn't make as much sense.
Yeah, so good. Right. Good question. Okay. So, very, very much the sort of our equity, desired equity stake in companies is very relevant to what we're hoping to return as a fund.
Yep.
So, we're out fundraising for our next fund, and we're looking at returns of 3 to 5x net of the fees we're charging as well, right? So when you map that out, and again, everyone has a different strategy. Some funds are doing 10 investments a year, 5 to 10 investments a year, we're doing 40. So our strategy will be different. One of the things where we've had to educate a lot of our LP base, which isn't used to guys like
an LP
us,
is...
limited partner into our fund, basically, is investing into our fund, is how do you make the math work where you're going to be able to return three to 4x? So if we do our jobs really well and get to that kind of a return, and why that kind of a number? Because that essentially means an internal rate of return of more than 15-20%. And why is that? Because that's really good.
Yeah.
So, because what do you get at the bank right now? Like 0%,
about
whatever
zero.
It is, right?
Yeah.
And a really safe return is 6-7% IRR. So if you're doing 15, 20, 30, 40, obviously that's very, very good, right?
Sure.
To get really basic there. So that's what we're kind of quote unquote promising. And so to deliver that, we look at, all right, if this fund is going to be 120 companies, that's our objective, right? Because that's how we operate. What are the equity stakes we need at kind of the exit points of these companies and knowing our death rates? So now we have a track record. We know what in fund 1, 2, 3, what are the percentage of companies shutting down? At our stage, it's much higher than what, an index or Atomico will be comfortable with, right? So we're looking at, okay, what is, so actually in fund 3, it's a really, again, never talked about this before. So, hopefully they're quite interesting.
Hopefully Carlos won't mind.
Yeah, hopefully Carlos won't mind. No, and it's an we're actually going to release our fundraising deck probably after close the fund.
Yeah,
so that
really
should be pretty interesting. But we looked at, we did 120 investments in fund 3. We've looked at our top 25 or 30 investments, and we've, they're valued at about $500 million. And that's a year or two after writing the check. So it's like, okay, they're roughly valued at $20 million each.
Mm-hmm.
Do we think that's healthy? Because we tend to remember get in at a 1 to 3 or 4 million valuation.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn healthy, right?
Two and a half
years in. And then we're looking at, okay, well, can this in aggregate, this whole portfolio, probably especially the top third of it, be worth $3 billion? Because at our ownership stake then of roughly 2% on aggregate again of $3 billion, it's $60 million.
Yep.
Our fund is $20 million, 3x.
Yep.
And then upside, right?
Sure.
So we're like, is it realistic? We're going out to fundraise and we're going to pitch the story to LPs with a serious face saying, give us $50 million now, right? And saying, looking at our $20 million fund, is $60 million possible? Can these companies be worth 6x today?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very likely, right? And we think more, right? And hence we're like, when we're catching up with the Revolut guys and so forth, we're like, yep. We're headed in that direction, property partner and so forth. We're headed in that direction. So it becomes very realistic. Now take that back to you guys as a gravel, looking at your round, I'd be like, okay, where does this fall into? Where are we in the life of the fund? Is this a 10xer? And so we can't win with 10x. Our death rate is so high that we can't win with 10x. We need, 80x, 100x, 1000x to make our fund work. private equity needs 2x, 3x, hence because their death rates are so low.
Yeah.
Index needs, you know, you hear 10x often from VCs, like the bigger VCs, because that's according to their death rate and their size of fund. Yeah. We know 10x doesn't work for us. So when we look at a Gravel or others, it's like, can this be 50x? And then you look at, you know, what companies are getting bought out for. And we had this conversation downstairs in the cafe. It's like, if your growth rate is crazy and you're gonna do that in the next two, three years, your M&A has to be like $500 million close to it for that to make sense if you're not really generating much revenue. If you're starting to generate revenue, then that's all you're going to be measured by. And so ultimately, you know, for it to work for us, it's got to be 500 million plus for certain companies, or billion or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so your revenue has to be $500 million or $1 billion at least, because public companies are getting valued at often like 2x revenue, 3x revenue.
Yeah.
And so you see, if you start to then backwards, you know, do that math, you arrive with like, all right, is this company going to make 100x for us?
Yes.
And so you say no sometimes, not because it's not great, and not because it's not going to make some
just wrong
awesome
stage.
Money for wrong stage, wrong, you know, just wrong fit for us.
So can you give us an idea, Ian, you've done this, your third fund?
Yeah.
So can you give us an idea of the various successes and death rates by percentage or raw numbers per fund? Just to give listeners some insight to know that actually VCs do have a lot of logic behind their calculations.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's a European thing, is we had a lot of low death rate early on. And I think in Europe, you tend to last longer. I think you get to revenue faster. And so you can just sort of live on that, right? You can live on 1 to 5 million in revenue for quite a long time right here. So if you look at Fund One, we had only 22 companies in there. That model doesn't work to find really outsized winners. So at the stage we're doing, we figured out it needs to be like 100, 120 companies, potentially even more, but we've certainly found our sweet spot to be 100, 120. So in the first fund, we only had like a quarter of them die, but we also didn't have $1 billion business so far come out of it. We've got a few great companies in there, so we'll see, but it's not looking like that'll potentially happen, right? But there, the fund was 2 million, so 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. So for us, 10 million exits made a lot of money. 50 million, 100 million exits made us tons of money, because our ownership stakes were also enough that if they didn't raise tons of money, then those exits were brilliant, actually. Yeah. You know, as we move up, what we've seen with Fund 2 and Fund 3 is nearly a 50% death rate. That's huge. So, you know, if you jump from 25 to double your death rate, the pressure on the returns is, you know, doubled, right? And so every check we're writing, when you have 50% loss, you're essentially saying, I didn't invest 75K. I invested 150, basically, you know? So again, those pressure, and I'm still getting the same equity.
Yeah.
So the pressures are just so much higher. So we've seen 25 to more like 50% now.
Okay. And then...
And we're successful.
Yes,
so,
true.
You know, it's crazy.
So how does that all trickle down to... So you and Carlos run the fund. So does that mean you guys are living in gold-plated mansions in Bishop's Avenue yet? Or not quite yet?
I've not invited you to my house.
No. Mansion, if you don't mind.
Mansion.
Castle. How does that work, genuinely, from a co-founder of a fund perspective?
Like,
you know, you guys pick the winners,
make
the decisions.
Yeah.
You obviously deserve the biggest reward for it. Even if it's not your money, it's all making all the decisions for everyone else. How does that actually work?
So usually, you hear a lot around 220. So, and people don't know generally what that means, but usually there's like a fee of somewhere around 2%.
Right.
And actually LP, limited partners, are putting a lot of pressure on those fees, right? So these...
It's like a management fee, right?
Yeah. Management fee, basically salaries, right? For people. And so usually the fund life is 10 years and you might add on another year or two. Frankly, I think for the stage where we're at, it should be longer, but your IRRs then get impacted. So nobody kind of wants to do it longer than 10 years. People feel like that's a long lockup for money anyways, because you know that LP money is locked up in there. And so throughout that 10-year time, you will get returns. Like you'll have exits. And for us, they often start at year 3. your 3 to 4, 5, and then continue. So you get this almost like an annuity stream for another 5 or so years from exits that are happening, liquidity that's happening. So anyway, so that fee can be 2% annually for 10 years, 20% potentially of the fund, or less, right? Or more. And we had some crazy fee in fund one, which was just too silly to almost talk about. It was so high. And then we...
Was TransferWise in fund one?
No, fund two. Oh. Which was a crazy fee as well.
Oh, but what a shame.
Yeah, yeah. And then and then you hear of like a 20% carry, which is a fancy word for saying profit share. Okay. And actually, it's not different to your ownership stake. So say you own 20% of Grabble.
Yeah.
You know that if you have a liquidation preference, all your investors are going to get their money first anyways.
Yeah.
So our carry is essentially that, is like all our investors are going to get their money first.
Right,
and then so it's, but we keep essentially, say it's 20%. Some funds get away with 30%. Mm. Some are lower. We essentially have a 20% ownership of that fund as partners for the whole life of it. It never gets diluted essentially. Right. So, all of that to say, you know, are we living in what Bishop's Avenue, right? No, not quite yet. Which, because it's long.
Yeah.
It's longer than you guys, right? You guys will exit in potentially 3 years, 5, 7.
Fact to any listener.
Yeah, fact. No, potentially, right? And some of you will be there for 14, 15 years or longer. But you'll have a life-changing moment, sometimes within a year, sometimes 5, sometimes 10. We realistically won't have that life-changing moment for 10 years.
Right.
And look at me now, 10 years later, and we've returned our first fund, and I am in that quote unquote carry. Yeah. So I am getting returns out of that.
Sure.
But we also have to reinvest into our next fund. So it's like, I'm like, okay, here you go. I got it in one hand and out the other, right?
So is this a lifetime commitment? It kind of sounds like it, because it doesn't really sound like there's ever really a natural end to the cycle.
Yes.
And you're always going to be so fucking curious about what's going to happen.
Yes. It is. It's emotional. It's practical in that you're taking money from one hand and always sort of, and again, our LPs are putting a lot of pressure on us, putting more and more of our money into our personal money into our fund. So you got to, it's called a GP commit. So, you know, so that's all happening. So you do get into this pattern. And because you, just like you guys, you have key man and you're making sure you've got an option pool and you're vesting. Not dissimilar for us is our LPs want to know, you know, are Carlos and Reshma going to actually buy it? Are they going to actually work on this? Right.
Yeah.
Or are we putting this money in and they're kind of like, bye, see you later. So that's critical too. So you're locked into these sort of 3, 5, usually in the life of the fund, 10 years.
Yeah.
So you see, you know, you'll hear VCs often tweet about, I just signed up for another 10 years. So it becomes this cycle either can be virtuous because you are super successful and it works for everyone, or it can be quite vicious. And in that people, this is controversial, but maybe like Arsene Wenger, who's, you know, maybe you should leave now, right?
Sure. Arsenal. Speaking to an Arsenal fan, so it's the other thing. It's all I talk about, entrepreneurship and that. So,
yeah, and so for us, it's the same. It's like, in how many funds should I leave? Or Carlos leave?
Aren't great
leave,
yet. Right? Carlos is bald, he's balding. So I guess he's taking one step closer in more stress than Arsene Wenger. Coming back to the nature of how a fund works, and this is hopefully the last question, just so people get a really clear understanding. You obviously have to get your money out of companies in each fund. So how does the wrapping up look like? And obviously this news just a couple of weeks ago with TransferWise, that is an example, right? You had to get the money out. So what's the process and why do you have to do it? And what's the pressure on you for that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, we talked about... potentially money is locked up for 10 years. No one really wants that, right? And for multiple reasons. And so one of the things, you know, we were conscious of, and this is a discussion that goes hand in hand with our LPs and often with our founders. The founders who really understand fund dynamics understand this and understand why venture capital is right for them or is absolutely not right for them. So I think those who get it get that, you know, we're looking at liquidity points, and it doesn't have to be you selling your business. There's other ways to get liquidity, which we'll go through with TransferWise. But it is, you know, your VC is going to want liquidity, whether that's unlikely in the first year or otherwise, why are we in this business? But it's going to be in that kind of 3, 5, 7 year time frame, and maybe 10 years if it's looking at a, you know, $5-10 billion business, right? So towards that, so I think it's a healthy conversation and with people who get it. And if you're too emotional about it, it's a pretty rubbish conversation. Mm-hmm. So in TransferWise's case, I mean, we came in, you know, in that sort of that pre-seed application process and so forth. So obviously we had specific terms around that, which were on our website, like, you know, 50K for 10%, right? So that kind of level of evaluation, and they're, you know, rumored to be at a billion plus in valuation, right? So it's kind of like, all right, where are we around this table? It's like, that's a huge, you know, that's it. That's a huge uplift. We were the first.
It's a huge rumor.
It's a huge rumor. We were, you know, we've been the only ones in that cap table that first kind of first days, right? Is it sensible to take some money off the table? So again, it doesn't have to be the pressure of sell your business. And that can happen, right? You get boardrooms where that conversation does happen.
But I guess if it's a high profile, high growth enough business, there's enough suitors to want to take it at this stage.
Exactly. So yeah. Our view, and we discussed it both, obviously first with the founders and with our LPs concurrently to say, you know, what do you guys think? Like, is that, again, with a great advisory board, is like, what do you think? Is it right to like take some money off the table? And so everyone kind of like, yeah, that sort of makes sense. And the founders are like, we'll help you, right? And so doing that process, we essentially said, let's take a small part of our stake off the table, which returned, you know, 90% of the fund, and let's let the rest be that upside, right? So as an asset manager, I think that's a very good asset manager who's thinking of the downside as well as the upside. Yeah. So we have a lot still riding on the business, but it's not the sort of, I have my home, I have food on the table sort of money, right? Mm-hmm. For our own LPs as such. So that's kind of the rationale around it. But you get some interesting pressures, especially as you get, you know, toward the end of the life of your fund, like that 8-year mark, 9-10 year mark. But if you're a good, investor, you've educated your entrepreneurs at year one that, look, you know, where do you want to be? If you want to run this 10 years, awesome. Let us know. Maybe you shouldn't raise, you want to run it 50 years, you know, then you've got to be conscious that these moments, you'll hear that around your board.
Yeah.
And you'll get people saying, all right, where's the liquidity point here, right?
So who actually finds the buyer? How does that process work? Is that your job?
Yeah, I mean, there's a market actually of advisors who focus on secondaries, as they're
like
called.
Bullhound or something.
Yeah, as they're called. And so we because I think the relationship in TransferWise is just so good on multiple levels, because the founders were like, great, we want to help you, we actually had an internal process. And so it saved a lot of fees. It was just a very straightforward process. But that said, it can go in many different directions depending on alignment of interests around the table as such.
Okay, that makes sense. So you've mentioned Deliveroo as a company you missed out on. Mm. What are the biggest other companies you've missed out on that you're like, they actually keep you up at night?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you know, CityMapper was another one, Data Hug and SkimLinks, SkimBit many years ago, and so that, I mean, you know, PipeDrive is another one as well. So you know, it's obviously like a bit of, you kind of smile at it,
yeah,
and you also want to. When you're alone, you cry about it as well. But
so,
it's the nature of it
a little bit. Yeah, you can't get them all right.
Well, especially at our stage, right? Because we're seeing such a.
What do you actually look for then? How do you say yes to one and no to another? Is it the founder, or is it the mission, or is it simply, like you said earlier, like, you know, have we already got our fingers in a couple of these pies?
Right. So I think it's a number of those things.
Politician's answer again.
No, because I think each case is different, right?
Yeah.
So we often will really fall in love with the founders and have a vision or have a belief that they will execute out of the roller coaster that it is, and all the pitfalls and also the up points, right? Sometimes you fall in love with the idea and think maybe the founders will somehow just manage it, even though they're not as capable as we'd like them to be potentially. And often we get that very wrong. So we really try to, you know, discipline ourselves around the latter and the former. We'll do it again and again. Backing the founders, we'll do that again and again and again. So
sure.
we just try to get better and better at the founder part. But of course you're looking at how big is this market? Like, so we were kind of tongue in cheek, like there's so many tools out there for VCs to manage portfolios. But you're like, gosh, how big is that market? I mean, and, you know, now we might miss it because we'll say, how big is that market, and pass. But maybe
I feel like we saw this on an email chain recently about some kind of, you know, fundraising process tool for VCs, etc.
Yeah. And there's like 100 companies doing this, right? But what you might see is one of them not only ends up having this tool for VCs, but for also angels, private equity. I mean, AngelList is, I guess, a good example of it in a different way. But so you'll see something emerge and you're like, oh, we missed it. And, but really at the time, you know, you're looking at 100, looks like a small market. You're not seeing, you know, so yeah, you try to make sure you're seeing those where the opportunities is, or where, you know, where those angles are.
Well, speaking of that, what do you actually think is the next big thing? What industry really excites you as a big growth area where CCAM can really get their teeth stuck into?
I mean, we're doing a lot in health tech. So where costs are dropping dramatically, where our money makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, do I think there's amazing work in sort of music and, you know, what Spotify has done? Like, yes, but we weren't able to play there, right? So it's also fit about where we can play.
Yeah.
And in you know, biotech, are there amazing pharmaceutical companies? Yes, but we couldn't have played there, right? But as biotech changes, and there's more tech around that, or as just generally health tech changes, and you know, things around manufacturing, etc., change, where the costs drop dramatically, our 150K, our 400K actually makes a difference.
Yeah.
And so those are the sectors, therefore, we get excited by, because it's saying, you know, this cost. So we have a company called The Rocket Company, and you gotta talk to the founder, Pari, one of these days. And it's sort of fascinating what they're trying to do. But they're essentially trying to completely change engineering around making things, especially expensive things. And, you know, if you can cut the process costs for getting a rocket into space by a tenth or a hundredth, or what, you know, is a hundredth of the cost, is incredible. It's hundreds of millions, right? What processes right now are you really solving that save you 100 million? There's not too many of those.
Sure.
We're thoroughly excited by that.
Yeah.
But we then again have to see, will 150K get him somewhere meaningful, or a million will get him somewhere meaningful to, you know, for that to happen, right? So those are some of the sectors that we're quite excited about.
Fair enough. Obviously, very big picture.
Obviously, artificial intelligence, but we look at it as a tech that then can be applied to dramatically reduce servicing and cost, potentially in a finance or in a property or whatever it is. Sense.
My question for you is, what attracted you to Europe? And, you know, you've got a South African husband, as I've seen. An American partner? Is Carlos American? I can never really work
so no,
out.
So back to, yeah, Carlos is actually Honduran originally.
There you
and
go.
He's a UK citizen.
Well, there you go. So, okay, him and Wyclef Jean are having a lovely time, as I understand it. But what attracted you guys to Europe? What is it about Europe? And, you know, what, like, have you had that challenge, you know, being not from here? And, like, what really makes it your thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are underdogs in that sense. And I guess it was such a perfect fit to back the underdogs of Europe, European founders, you know, if they're coming from Estonia, which now is obviously super popular. Yeah. But again, you know, 7 years ago, people were like, startup Estonia, you know, so or Slovenia or Romania or wherever, right? So I guess in a way that it was just, that was the attraction, is like, we can make a difference here.
Yeah.
And you know, personally, so I came to do my MBA at INSEAD, and I didn't choose to go to an American school because I just felt like I was one of many there. I mean, I'm an Indian American investment banker who did engineering.
That really is so rare.
That, yeah, right? There's just like thousands of us.
Yeah.
And so I came to Europe where...
It's like being a Jewish doctor.
And so I came to Europe. And I got just attracted to being different. A lot of people hate being different and they hate discomfort. I actually enjoyed it and thrive in it. So that was actually weirdly exciting to me.
Yeah.
So I think Carlos obviously had visa problems for the US because he studied in the US. And so he kind of had no choice. Like, he had to come here. His sister was here actually at the time already. So that was for him. So you can see we have a couple personal reasons why we're here, but, you know, for both of us is how do you give, and Saul has a lot of that kind of in him around kind of underdogs and giving them an opportunity,
South African,
and
right?
chance. Yeah, South African, right?
South Africans are often like that.
And yeah, absolutely. And so our team is made up of a lot of folks like that. Mm. And I guess there's a bit of hunger that comes with it. And you need that hunger at this stage to be, you know, working super hard and seeing opportunity and the risk.
So going back to where you're from, where Carlos is from, and you've been working together for, I guess, 10 years or coming
7 years,
up.
Yeah.
Okay, so 7 years. Are there things you massively disagree on? And have you had fallings out? And has that been a tough relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. I think originally when he came on in 2010, we had a lot of battles. And it's typical. Like I was, you know, he was coming in. Mm. I had already had 3 years of like, this is my baby and it's my thing, right?
Yeah.
And so, and it's great to be able to almost have gone through that, because when we talk to founders who are often either sole founders or, you know, teams that then are bringing on some pretty hyper talented individuals and they need to let go, we can actually talk about it from experience versus a lot of other, you know, other investors. So can't really relate to that. Right.
Sure.
So, but that was very difficult. I essentially had to, not it's not my baby anymore, it's ours together, and
yeah.
then and in future years it's going to be more people's
so thing, as the relationship right? develops, is it much more harmonious, or do you still fall out regularly, and what actually happens, does it ever happen where one of you is completely all in on one investment, the other one of you is just completely all out, and how do you mitigate those?
Two great questions there. Absolutely more harmonious, but also I would say you know, we still have different ways of looking at things and discussions about that. As we tell our child, mom and dad are not fighting. We're just having a discussion, right? So, but
we're just trying to make you more money, child.
And so, but what the thing is, both of us were actually trained as engineers. I pursued more of the business. Actually, we're both MBAs as well. I pursued more the kind of business side of it, and he. At the beginning, especially of his career, was implementing engineering systems. So we were very different in a lot of our thinking, but actually at the base, we have an engineering mindset and a sort of problem, hypothesis, solution way of working.
Mm-hmm.
So we just sometimes have very different ideas around it, but you know, our core values, I guess, are same. And our core process is roughly the same. So hence we find so much common ground. So that answers that question in terms of like, what one of us believes fundamentally in a business or and the other one doesn't. So we're lucky, I guess, because we do, you know, 30, 40 investments a year, we can have that disagreement and do the deal.
Okay.
Because we're not, so that we don't have that competition internally, is because again, we have a volume of that.
Mm.
We just don't have to deal with that competition, which is actually quite an issue sometimes in funds that are limited by number of deals they can do.
Yeah.
And there's a real allocation of whose deal it is. We don't have that at CCAMP either. It's like, it's the platform's deal, like a TCAS deal, you know?
Okay,
so that really has helped. Those are not the you know, those are not the conflicts we have. We have different ones just around like, you know, things around marketing or tech, and then we know which of us is actually the better person for it, and we kind of say, all right, you know, you're
from experience, you just do this.
Yeah, not only you're more passionate, but you actually know more about this, and so.
So I asked you before the interview to give me a friend to give some background on you and tell us a little bit about yourself, but you chose Alex Hoy. As much as I love Alex Hoy, you know, writes and speaks in shorthand, and I thought I'd be lucky to get even a syllable out of him that was intelligible. And I can say that because exactly. And he is the Gravel chairman, and he's one of our investors, and so I have a very good relationship with Alex, enough to know that that might have been a waste of my time. So instead, why don't you just tell me what you think of yourself? How do you describe yourself? Because now you've set yourself up with a difficult question by giving me a terrible reference point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's really your own
bad
fault
job,
in the making.
Bad job.
So
true,
describe
you're
yourself.
Right. You're right. You could have asked Philip.
Well, listen, I asked you for a name and you gave me a name and I have enough experience too. Yeah, I called it, and that's fair. So now you have to tell us about yourself. Describe yourself.
Gosh. Well, I hope one of our strengths, I think, is you have to be self-aware. I think if you're in venture, you're working with so many different kinds of people and over such different timelines. Mm. I think you have to be fairly self-aware. So
I love
hopefully...
meta, the answer to describe yourself, be self-aware. It's a very meta answer. But continue.
So, No, I think what we, you know, what I obviously have done probably better than a lot of people out there is work well with people. So like people get along and, you know, I've gotten this group of, again, 30, 40, 50 different LPs and these, you know, all to work together and our companies. And so, I mean, I think there's inherently like people used to ask a lot at the beginning. It's like, how do you get all these people in a room to just come and give their time? And we've obviously done that through network and help. But it,
do you feel like a chameleon in that sense? Like, are you quite good at changing your personality to your audience?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, maybe that's a negative in some people's eyes. I think it's transparent. I do it transparently, I hope, and I think it works well because I think it's saying you understand you're willing to understand your customer. You're willing to see it.
It's just marketing.
From their shoes, right? Like, when we talk to a founder about this is our offer, how are they going to look at it? What are they going to think? You know, so we are a bit of a chameleon. I guess it helps that I was born in India. I joke a lot about this. It's like, I was born in India, so I can relate to, like, what is that? One fifth of the world. I grew up in America. So I can, you know, relate to a pretty successful country there and mindset there. I had a lot of Jewish friends. I used to go to synagogue a lot, actually, growing up. So I'm like, I love, you know, I love that culture, right? And I've gone to Shabbat dinners and stuff, right? I love that culture. So I can relate to a lot. I work and live in Europe. So clearly I can relate to that. I think it was very tough the first few years, kind of humor, everything was very tough.
And your husband's
tough.
From South Africa.
And my husband's from South Africa. So
and you
I
once
think
saw Antarctica on a map.
Yeah. So I'm missing, and Carlos is Honduran, so I can't cover Latin America, but he can.
Sure.
So chameleon is probably, I mean, the name, like at the heart of it, right? Cause you just have to, you have to work with so many different people. You're kind of like, yeah, I get it. Like, I've, you know, been in these different situations and I see how you see the world.
So we have to start wrapping up. So what I'm going to ask you is, and you're the best person I think we could actually ever ask this question to, which is, what are the biggest mistakes you see founders make?
Yeah. I mean, I think, so founders probably corollary to what I just said is, like, I don't think founders put themselves in the shoes. They're very egocentric in a way, right? In a way, you have to be to go on a mission to try to change the world, save the world. So that said, you're going to have to work with a lot of different constituencies, and they're not listening, like they're not hearing those constituencies out. Team, their employees, who they're hiring, why people reject their offers if they do, who keeping those teams, again, users, customers, lawyers, investors. So they're not listening. So I think that's often a big kind of mistake that they make. And I guess for the nature of what we care about, being very commercially driven, right? They're often, again, also the ones who don't do it well necessarily are not, again, thinking about that long-term picture. Like, you're building a business. If
you're
money. Yeah. And if you want impact kind of business, or then it's different, right? Mm-hmm. Go to different people. And there are some amazing people who that were chair NGOs or charities, amazing people that are obviously doing that work. It's just not us or not potentially venture capital. Right.
Yeah.
So those couple of,
and do you see founders fall out a lot?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we see that a lot because we see it. So we see them so early in their formative stages. It's honestly down to communication a lot. Again, not listening out to each other. Because so one of the other things about what I feel hopefully I'm good at, and again, that comes out, is like usually when there's so we deal with a lot of fire alarms, right? Like constant red alert. Like when it's going good, we just don't hear about it. And we're always hearing about whether that's founder fallouts or whatnot. And what I guess the only way I found not to get my stress levels completely out of whack every single day that we do this is to just first kind of get everybody calm and say, okay, what do you think is happening? What do you think is happening? And then you realize, like, there are a lot of assumptions. That's a huge mistake I think all of us make, is like you always assume going into whatever situation, and often the conflicts come from that. Because if you're co-founders, again, you probably have similar values. Otherwise, why are you co-founders? And you probably have a similar mission because you wrote it on a board somewhere, right? So if those two things are there, then somewhere in that, if there's breakup happening, either there's an external event and you can't perhaps do something about, like illness or death or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right. Or, so that's fine. And you got to deal with that a bit differently, but mostly it's like, it's likely you made some assumptions about each other and where things are, you know, coming from, and also a lot of bad then communication.
Yeah.
Between.
Okay. Final couple of questions. The first is a two-parter, which is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given on your journey as an investor? And then what's the best piece of advice you have for people listening that want to start companies?
So as an investor, I think, our Saul, our board, I mean, always sort of saying, you know, you'll fall in love with all your companies and when you're investing, otherwise, why would you have? But you've got, you know, again, remember who you are and what you're here for. And you got to drill down on sort of what's important, because that the investor word there is the critical part, right? Is your, that's what you're doing.
And managing people's money.
Managing people's money. Yeah. And that's it. And what was the second question?
Second question is, what's the best piece of advice for listeners? So for budding entrepreneurs or even existing entrepreneurs?
I think, plan out your journey, right? Plan out the steps. And if you plan out the next 5 years and 10 years of what your business are going to look like, you'll have a lot more of the right answers most likely today. And for the next year and the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And that'll make your life a lot more stress-free and just easier for the whole team, probably.
Okay, so. Solid advice. And finally, your number one favorite investment of all time. Is it going to be really obvious, or are you going to throw a curveball and not say TransferWise?
I guess my favorite business of all time, and look, you got to, that's really unfair, but... I love the Zemanta guys. They were the first. They were first. It's like your first child.
Yeah.
And so in 2007.
Yeah.
And but I think it's just funny because I guess it's, I love them most, or not most, but I love them so much because
she said most.
I love them so much because I think it just, it brings it all back to a bit of humility. And obviously, I just think that's critical. At the end of the day, we're all going to die. And, you know, so. All you
what,
have is,
what did they do?
All you have is humility. So what it was is, you know, I said, oh, how did you find out about Zcamp? Like, are we so great? Like, oh, we got these amazing, you know, people around us, the founder Skype and da da da.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, well, it was really hot in Slovenia that summer. You know, not a lot of air conditioning going around. We had this one office where there was air conditioning and we were just really bored and browsing the internet. And we saw this competition that was giving out money. So, and that's how that's we amazing. Applied to Zcamp. And I was like, that's great.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so, it makes you have to, like.
And I presume it was a successful outcome.
Yeah, I mean, they're still working through it.
Yeah.
It's still,
good.
It's
okay.
It's never been a straightforward journey
yeah.
for them. But we've always had a great relationship. And sure, like, I don't think you should do this if you don't enjoy the people you work with and for and all of that. So that, but I just, I also think it'll always keep it real for me, at least. And that's sort of makes it one of my favorites. But the TransferWise guys, too.
Yeah,
and,
sure. And Apple.
And
anyway,
Apple.
And Apple. For anyone that wants to know how to be an investor, Apple can never go wrong. Okay. Thank you very much, Reshma.
So thank you very much to Reshma, who was quite an honest and amazing guest, telling us the brief history of venture capital, how it all works, and how you as an entrepreneur should be thinking about raising money, what seed means, what VC means, and the different stages that help you get from just an idea to a multi-billion dollar valuation like TransferWise. So I hope that's valuable for you guys. Rich, you obviously learned a lot because you've always come from a knowledge base of zero.
Yeah, it was an absolutely fascinating interview. I learned, even though having never raised a VC round in my life, I actually learned quite a lot about that.
Good. So taking a little break from just the classic entrepreneurs week in, week out, we wanted to mix it up a little bit. So this week you've had one of the UK's most respected venture capital investors. And next week we're going to bring you one of the UK's best-selling authors on entrepreneurship, the amazing Daniel Priestley, who's had four Amazon-topping business books written about entrepreneurship. The book that particularly helped him make his name was Entrepreneur Revolution. So we'll be taking a lot of perspectives of how he came over from Australia, entered the UK market, and became such a brilliant writer.
Yes, he's built a quite large following in the UK and globally with his books that are out. So
almost cultish.
You could say that. If you're into your business books, then you probably would have heard of Key Person of Influence or his new book, 24 Assets. But he's a very accomplished author, and, you know, definitely worth listening to the insights that he's got in the next episode.
Yeah, and he's a guy who actually spends all day, every single day, training and working with other entrepreneurs. So his insights are absolutely brilliant.
Don't forget to subscribe to us on the usual places. So that's YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes, and soon to be Spotify, which is very exciting.
Well, that's if they get back to us in time, but we're hoping by next week we'll be there. So where can people write to us, Rich?
People can write to us at hello@secretleaders.com, and you can also download and view all the background information in our interviews at secretleaders.com. So check it out there, and we will see you next week.